just making it in our existing elections, being allowed to vote digitally, I think that's great. And, you know, we're working hard to make that possible. But to me, what makes this so exciting is once we make things digitally, if we step back and look at the big picture, it actually opens a huge number of doors to much better ways of doing representative democracy.
Hey, welcome. Today we're sitting down with David Ernst. David Ernst is the inventor of secure internet voting, so welcome on.
Thank you very much.
So first of all, just tell me what this thing is that you created. It sounds self-evident from the name, secure internet voting, but what is it?
One way to think of it is in security land, in digital land, it's supposed to be voting in a digital setting. And it's really easy to vote. We actually vote all the time. Anytime someone's on Instagram or Reddit or YouTube, people are hearting things and upvoting things, or basically all of social media involves some voting one way or another. But there are a lot of insecurities in the way that that's being done. And so it's really a protocol. We call it the SIV protocol. Sort of similar in some ways to like the Signal protocol is how it's one way to achieve secure peer-to-peer messaging, direct messaging. This is how an algorithm that you can achieve secure voting. And voting has some unique problems. And so that's sort of how we think about it. Sort of like with going from HTTP to HTTPS. This is like, okay, if you want to do voting in a digital setting, how can you do it in a secure way?
And I think, you know, a lot of us don't really think about what we're doing every day is voting, like liking that thing on Instagram or rating something, you know, on DoorDash or something. But yeah, we're voting all day. And I think that we don't really think about what we're doing when we're doing that. But when it comes to like our elections for actual elected officials, for the government, or maybe even if we're electing our union people or, you know, there's a lot of settings that we might vote in a more official capacity where we think like, I don't really care if my likes are miscounted on Instagram, but I do care if my vote for like my congressperson is correctly counted, right?
Exactly.
What are those unique challenges that are posed for being able to vote online for something where we have maybe that higher expectation?
The sort of like status quo belief for the last 20 years is people have been saying, oh, wouldn't it be great if we could vote in government elections from our home, from our computer, in our underwear? I don't know if people were saying that back then, but obviously that's implied.
We all want to be in our underwear as much as possible.
Exactly. The part that makes it really tricky, there's basically three core security goals that you need to meet in order to have what's the highest level of security of an election, what's like for government grade elections, what we call free and fair elections. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing, just chronologically, is one person, one vote. Like people can't create 1,000 accounts. They can't mm-hmm. vote millions of times. The only people that should be allowed to vote are the people from the actual voter roll. And so you need some sort of authentication around who's actually participating. And it's not an impossible problem. There's lots of settings that we do that. We pay taxes. We pay for credit cards. We do a lot of things that are tied to our identity. And so it's not impossible. But it can be tricky to do at scale, and in particular, it conflicts with the other goals. So the next one, like you're talking about, is making sure your vote itself, the actual choice that you make, isn't being tampered with. And so, yeah, like you meant to vote for George Washington, it shouldn't be changed to Benedict Arnold.
Yeah.
And so that you're actually getting correct results. Okay, here's the set of people that we established. This is what everyone's choices are. And now we get some sort of tally. And then the last piece, and this is what makes it unusually difficult and unusually hard, is for government elections, there is a lot of philosophy around this in history that there's a really strong requirement for privacy. Mm-hmm. And this is the thing that a lot of people don't necessarily, it's not the first thing that people think about, but in the American history, we didn't used to always have a secret ballot. It used to be the case that you just go up, like everyone would stand out in like the city of the center of the town. And like, if you wanted to support this candidate, you'd walk over there. If you want to support that candidate, you'd walk over there. And so there was a lot of fears around like bribery things. And
that still
coercion happens
in some cases. That's what they do at the caucuses.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. The Iowa caucus still does this, but it's like the one exception. Almost nowhere else does it.
And it's kind of weird. It feels so antiquated to vote like that, right?
Exactly. But for the average person, especially for the general election, you're usually getting a piece of paper and you have a bunch of names and you're checking the box next to one of the names. You're like connecting the line or doing something where you're picking one of the people. And the theory is it's supposed to be private. There's a few reasons for that. Like I was saying, one fear is around bribery attacks. Another one is like that your employer will pressure you to vote a certain way at risk of you losing your job.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is, again, this gets to the point of what's called a free and fair election, is because we're talking about reelecting, like, let's say, the mayor or the governor or the president. And there's fear that you're basically saying, should they be rehired or not, right? Should they serve? OK, they've served the last 4 years or whatever their term is. Should they get an extension of 4 more years? And so the fear is that if they know how you voted, some thugs might show up at your house and beat you up.
Yeah.
If you didn't, you know, if you're not supporting the regime.
And then there's a million subtle ways that they can try to disenfranchise you, right?
Totally. And so now, because of state constitutional amendments, that we have a constitutional right to a secret ballot.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what makes it really hard to do things digitally, is there's this fundamental tension between that hardcore privacy requirement where the administrator is not supposed to know how you voted, which is not true on Instagram or any of these platforms, that they know exactly what you liked or not. But then at the same time, have strong authentication of who's voting, and also at the same time, have some sort of defenses against your vote being stolen and changed and tampered with, which can there's a few different places where that can be introduced. So achieving all these at the same time is a surprisingly difficult question if you looked in the details.
And how do you solve especially that, like, I need this vote to be tied to my identity and I want something that's secure, that's not going to expose me to and my data to, you know, attacks?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so there's just this fundamental tension between like transparency and privacy and verifiability and authentication. And so that's what the Civ protocol is meant to solve. And so we have been working on it. We started working on it in 2020. And so now it's been used a huge amount. The other thing is we really want to make it really easy for people as well. Like the security side of the equation is very important, but there's also the accessibility side of the equation. Yeah. And so if it's so difficult to use that nobody's actually using it, it's as good as if it's not actually happening. And so I can tell you about how it actually works. At a very high level, the Civ protocol, it's sort of a digital implementation of vote by mail. And what that means is that there's an election administrator who defines a voter roll. And they say, okay, here's all the people that are allowed to vote. And they say, and they also define, here is the ballot that people are going to be voting upon. And then you receive an invitation. For each person that's allowed to vote, they come up with what's called a voter code, like a unique identification number for each voter. And so that's tied to each person. They say, okay, Alice got this one, Bob got this one, Charlie gets this one. And so they give that to you in some form. That could be over email, it could be over postal mail, it could be in person. And then you take your code and you load up the ballot. And so you can see, okay, here are the questions that you're voting on. And what happens is, from your point of view, you're just clicking the options for, I want to vote for George Washington, or I want to vote for Abraham Lincoln. But what happens under the hood, and this is one of the really cool things about it, is your own device actually encrypts your vote locally on your client side in your browser. You don't have to install anything. It's quite nice, although you can if you want to. And then what you send in is an encrypted vote. And so the analogy, it's similar to vote by mail, in that what happens with vote by mail is you get mailed a blank ballot as a voter on the voter roll. You fill out your piece of paper, and then you seal it inside the envelope. You fold it up, you put it in the envelope, you lick the envelope, and you sign the outside. And so you send in this envelope to the administrator in the Dropbox or over the mail, and now they've received millions of envelopes. And they know, okay, this envelope's from Alice, this one's from Bob, this one's from Charlie, but the actual content of your vote is inside the encryption. And so we do the exact same thing. Your device is creating this little encrypted payload, and on the outside, you put that voter code, that identification number. And so you're sending in this sealed encrypted vote with your name on the outside. And then after all the votes come in, the administrator has received all the votes from all the voters, or as many as, you know, the period is closed. Then there's this other really mathematically cool thing, which is called a cryptographic shuffle, which uses this technique called a mixnet, where it's basically like you're putting all the votes in a hat and you're mixing them all up. And before you do that, you actually remove the stamps. So mm-hmm. first you say, okay, this one is from an approved voter. This one's from an approved voter. They haven't submitted twice.
So you know that, you know who's voted at correct. That point.
Exactly.
You don't know what their votes are.
Exactly.
Then they go in the hat and they get mixed up.
Exactly.
And you find out what the votes are, but not
exactly.
who voted.
Exactly. So so it's this anonymization step that happens after all the votes are received that breaks the link between the identities of the voters and the individual selections. And then all the votes just get opened up. And there's some fancy cryptography to do that in a privacy protecting way. And then you just have the list of all the individual selections. And so everyone can see. And it's, the math is really cool and really interesting, but actually using it is shockingly fast and easy. I mean, tens of thousands of people have used it at this point. They say it's the best voting experience they've ever had. It's super easy. And it also happens to have all these really nice verifiability features to, interestingly, a higher degree than you can get from paper. We didn't set out to do that. That wasn't the goal. But it just so happens that because we're using computers, we can layer in all these nice verifiability things.
So why doesn't this exist in the real world? Like we yeah. said at the top of the show, like, I think we all say, why can't I just vote on the internet? I have my credit card that's linked to my identity. I have all this stuff that is personal and private that is still linked to my identity that I do online. Every other aspect of my life can be managed on the internet, but I still have a paper ballot, or I have to go to a local polling place. I have to vote by mail.
Totally.
And voting still seems so old school. Maybe there's something that makes us feel better about it, that I've gone to my polling place and I've used a pen to fill in and I handed my vote to an election worker. But, I mean, it seems like, okay, I don't want to get on a soapbox or anything. But
please, get on a soapbox.
To me, one of the biggest problems with our elections, I'm speaking mostly about, like, you know, in American politics, is probably just participation. Because voting can be a pain, right? You do have to remember to go vote somewhere. If it's election day and you haven't made the time for it, it can be hard to get to your polling place. It can be hard to remember to mail in your ballot, even if you've had a mail-in ballot delivered to you. But I feel like if I were able to vote from my phone or from my laptop, I mean,
much easier.
Yeah, it's so
much
easy.
Faster.
So it would just, like, really juice that, you know, like, voter turnout, probably, right? So it's like, why don't we do it? It's easier for everyone. It would probably mean more democracy, which is, like, what we're for. So what's standing in our way?
Yeah. So just a lot of great nuggets to dig into there. Just specifically on the participation thing, we just ran this election in December, so about 2 months ago. And it was the largest majority digital election for a government official in American history. There were 70,000 eligible voters. This was in Utah to elect a state senator.
Mm-hmm.
So the winner has now been sworn in. They're now in the state Senate. So that was really exciting, and it went super well, and everyone loved it. And just specifically on this point about participation, our philosophy is not that this should be forced on anyone. You don't have to trust any of the code or the computer or the apps or anything like that. It's just meant to be an additional option, mm-hmm. people that can look in the deals that they want. But we're not trying to get rid of the existing options, just let people use what they want to use. And so in this election, we made sure to help set up in-person voting as well and paper voting as well. And so there were 9 different polling stations that people could visit. And in this particular election, for everyone that cast a paper vote in person, there were 50 people that cast a digital vote.
Wow.
50-1, literally.
That's an insane ratio.
It's crazy for this particular. And that's not going to hold in every case. I mean, this was an unusually high. It's a pretty rural area. It's like.
No, but I mean, like yeah. You want to talk about user preference, though.
Correct.
I mean,
50-1.
50-1 is pretty convincing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so just to your. We don't have to speculate so much about the participation. I mean, there are other votes. Partly it's like there was low turnout already. So. People, there wasn't a ton of interest in driving to the polling stations.
Yeah.
And so making it a lot easier increased the turnout a lot. But a lot of the downstream elections are like that. Like, local elections typically have very low turnout yeah. rates. And
any non-presidential election, even the national elections and the midterm elections, famously lower right. turnout than presidential. You know,
totally.
Years.
And now I don't want to overstate just the logistics of how you cast your vote. I think there's a lot more going on as well when it comes to participation rates. Yeah. Another, like, just me speaking personally, if you know, someone else chose the ballot design, right? And so if the choices on the ballot, none of them resonate with me, none of them speak to me, no matter how easy it is, I still don't care that much about that. And so that's another aspect of the situation that I think could be improved a lot, is just having much better options on the ballot itself.
Yeah, that'd be nice, huh?
Yeah. Well, and so that's actually one of the really exciting pieces about this. Like, just making it in our existing elections, being allowed to vote digitally, I think that's great. And, you know, we're working hard to make that possible. But to me, what makes this so exciting is, once we make things digitally, if we step back and look at the big picture, it actually opens a huge number of doors to much better ways of doing representative democracy. And so our ballots themselves can fundamentally change in some really interesting and attractive and appealing ways. And so if you're just taking this as like, okay, our existing elections, but you can vote for your phone, that's nice. I definitely think that that is a stepwise improvement. Mm-hmm. But I think we could get like radically better governmental systems, the things that we're all paying a third of our income into as taxes, as controlling trillions of dollars, huge amounts of GDP, is deciding wars, is deciding what people are getting locked up for crimes. I mean, there's a much bigger picture here. And I personally see this as a stepping stone. There was this great line that one of our supporters used many years ago, that this is like a web browser. And so, like, just get it. It's our fundamental basic right to vote is like the first, it's like the key right that distinguishes between living in some sort of republic, free country, versus living under some sort of authoritarian monarchy system. Yeah. Is like, do you have a voice over your government? And so right now we just, that our voice over our government does not exist in a digital setting legally at all. We have all this like non-formal, informal sort of stuff like TikTok and Twitter and NewYorkTimes.com and op-eds. Yeah,
we have ways to influence opinion, right?
Yeah, right. And it's really rich. I mean, there is a lot of discussion happening there. But our legal mechanism is once every 2 years or once every 4 years, you can effectively pick between two people. And so if you think about it from like a technology, from like an information theory point of view, it's one bit. Right? It's a binary option, like reelect the person or not.
One or
every
zero.
Every 2 years. Yeah, correct. Every 2 years. Which, like, if you just got to get on a single Zoom call or, like, you watch a single YouTube interview, like, one Netflix movie could easily be a gigabyte, like a billion bytes. And so it's like the way that I personally think about it is that voting and democracy and elections, it's like a conversation that we're all trying to have, like a community conversation, like, do we like this vision of the future more? Or do we like that vision of the future more? And so right now we're using it with something that's radically lower bandwidth than a telegram,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, imagine like beep, 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 like SOS. But that's like many bits per minute at least. This is one bit every 2 years. And so the quality of the conversation is all being bottlenecked, and it's so teeny, teeny, tiny. And so to me, that's what's really exciting about this, is we can open up an entirely new avenue. And I see Civ as the bridge between our legal formal mechanisms of picking our leaders and this richness that we have created of the internet. But right now, all these things, the internet things, they're suffering from all these sock puppet accounts. There's always like fake bot influence campaigns. Mm-hmm. And again, like if I run a poll on Twitter, it's like a single command for someone to, you know, just forge whatever results they want. Like, right, those numbers are 100% unverifiable, and there's no privacy, which has all sorts of implications around like our whole ad-driven environment system. So the point is, to me, the big vision is, can we connect our legal mechanisms with this richness of our digital ecosystems? And that's sort of what we see Civ as being the potential to help facilitate.
And I want to go back a little bit to like why we aren't there yet.
Right.
Because we're going to talk about problems or roadblocks in the way of this happening. So first, technically, are there technical roadblocks that are like, this technology just isn't there yet to be able to vote online?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what people have been saying for many years. And so there's basically two major reasons for why it hasn't been happening yet, or maybe three major reasons that I could point to. So one is about technical barriers. It's just like, You ask the smartest experts, like Turing Award winners, Nobel Prize scientists, esteemed professors, and they will tell you, and they've published all these reports, we do not know how to do this in a safe enough way that can meet the requirements of government elections. Mm-hmm. And it's literally a matter of national security. It's yeah. like, you know, the winner of this contest is going to have the nuclear codes. And so we don't want it to be such... We need to, you know, like Stuxnet, if you're familiar with this big hack. It was supposedly a joint operation of the NSA and Mossad against these Iranian nuclear yeah, facilities.
The one that broke the centrifuges.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. And supposedly it involved like 23 different 0 days all labeled together. And these centrifuges were all air-gapped. And there was like, they dropped these USB sticks in the parking lot and people picked them. And there was like all sorts of crazy stuff going on.
Yeah. The actual... like data breach happened because one of these USB sticks was picked up and plugged into the one of the computers that was networked to the things running the centrifuges, right?
Yeah.
Is that what happened?
I can't remember.
I think
that's one layer. I think it didn't even touch the centrifuges themselves, but it touched some of the other machines in the facility and then it jumped its way through.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. There's these crazy things where they can like, you can like send electromagnetic transmissions like over Wi-Fi. Like there's a lot of crazy stuff you can do with radio waves. Like now there's this whole thing about Wi-Fi can do like motion sensing. Like your router can see when you're walking around in the room or not. Like there's some crazy
really?
Stuff. Whoa. Yeah. There's like all these side channel attacks.
Just so we have it though. Can you just explain like the basic story of this, of the Stuxnet attack?
Yeah. Okay. So the high level idea is that the Iranian government for the last 50 years has been, since the Iranian Revolution, has been at war, not in diplomatic relations with the U.S. Mm-hmm. and Israel in particular. And they had this nuclear program. There have been all these sanctions. And so some, at the time, unknown actor, although now both the NSA and Mossad have claimed a lot of credit, somehow got some sort of cyber weapon into these Iranian centrifuges. And there's like 200 of them. And the point of the centrifuges is you take unenriched uranium, you spin it around really fast, and it separates out the unenriched from the enriched isotopes. And so it's a necessary step of building nuclear weapons and also nuclear power plants. And so the theory is basically they were able to get malware onto the computers that control these centrifuges that got them to speed up and slow down. Like usually they're supposed to spin at a constant rate.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this isn't my area of expertise, but I'm just really interested in the subject. So don't quote me on it. I'm not an authority on the subject, but basically the theory is that they tricked the motors that run the centrifuges into going really fast and then going really slow. And that caused a bunch of jerk. And so that actually caused the centrifuges to like overload and break. And the theory is this set back the nuclear program by 10 years or some sort of estimate.
And I remember it made big news because it was the first time or one of the first times that a cyber attack had like broken a physical machine, something in the kind of real world, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was supposedly the estimates are that it was like $1 billion operation. I mean, it's like a huge piece of cyber intelligence all being poured. Again, it's like 23 zero days or something yeah. like that, where each one of these is worth a lot of money and they all got layered together. And so the reason I just bring this up is because going back to a voting context, an elections context, there's a very genuine and well-founded, sincere fear that if you can get malware onto people's individual devices, or you can get malware onto the server that's collecting all the votes yeah. or tabulating all the votes, you could secretly tamper with the results, and now your entire election is a sham.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone voted for George Washington, but the results announced Benedict Arnold. And so that is a 100% sincere concern. And so we are building this protocol. Our design goal is that it is Stuxnet proof. Mm-hmm. That even if all the intelligence agencies of the world are trying to attack the thing, you can, it's not that it can prevent attacks, but that it's tamper evident. That's the framing that we're trying to achieve, is that you know whether your election result, you can follow certain steps and detect whether your election results are legitimate or not. And so that's a very sincere fear. And so that's kind of the highest level one, is like, you don't want your election results to be a sham. And again, there's a lot of different avenues of where that could happen. Again, like the server. The other big fear is on people's own devices themselves. Like, if people are voting from their own phones, they're running outdated software, they're running cheap budget phones, there's a lot of possible surface area there.
Yeah, I think that most people probably don't have great cybersecurity habits
100%.
Or protocols on their own devices.
Totally.
Even those of us out there who are like aware of it are probably like, we go, I know I should be doing better, but it's hard, you know, I don't have the time to think about it. So yeah.
Totally. And so the fundamental thing there is like, if some piece of malware steals, let's say you're into cryptocurrency and it steals your cryptocurrency private keys, it can empty your entire wallet. Mm-hmm. It can take all your money. I think this is a good thing, but at least you can find out about that.
Yeah.
You look at your wallet and you see that it's empty.
Right, yeah.
I think that's a good thing. Maybe, I don't know exactly, but it's different. Or like, it, set aside cryptocurrency, just your normal bank account, it gets in your normal bank account, it wires all your money to the hacker's account. Next time you go to the store and you try to buy something, it's like your card is rejected. There's no more balance there. And so the point is, you know whether or not you are the victim of a hack. The fear is with elections, because again, no one is supposed to know how you voted. If you can intercept the vote after you made your selection, but before it gets tallied, potentially no one even ever finds out that the results are illegitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a very sincerely founded fear. The good news is there are some answers. It's not an impossible problem. There are some other more cynical arguments against this. Another very common thing that people ask me all the time is, do the powers that be really want this?
Yeah.
Like you were saying, wouldn't it be great to make it easier?
That was actually my next question. Yeah. It's like, are there political challenges or power dynamic challenges?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the reality, it's hard to say, because again, this is cynical. No, there is no one, there are very few people, there's a few exceptions, but basically no one will say, I want to make it harder to vote. But like right this exact second, there's a big bill that just passed in the House of Representatives, now it's in the Senate, that's specifically trying to add some new requirements to registering to vote.
The Save America
Act.
Right,
that's the type,
right?
Exactly.
Yes, yeah.
And you have to show your proof of citizenship at time of registration. And if you're, it's trying to criminalize vote by mail as well, or ban vote by mail as well.
But when you're doing stuff like that, you have to couch it in the idea that you're still protecting elections.
Correct.
Even if your overall goal is lower voter turnout.
Correct.
You have to say, well, we are, you know, we're making sure the elections are secure.
Right. And it's not lower overall. Interestingly, politicians don't want lower overall, because politicians' entire mandate comes from saying, look, millions of people voted for me.
Yeah.
So actually, every politician wants as high turnout as possible, but that's a secondary goal to high turnout of my constituents.
Yes,
first.
Depress my opponent's turnout.
Exactly.
You know, try and get as many of my people to turn out. Yes.
Yeah. And so the thing is, I can't. It's a conspiracy theory in the mundane sense of we are theorizing about what their motivations are, and I don't really know. I can't really say, but that's definitely something that a lot of people raise. And so in this particular context, what the implications of that would mean is you would have more votes for more digitally native people, people that like using their phones. And so there's a lot of good data to suggest that that will almost certainly skew a lot younger, that there's a big age bias going on here. And if you look at voter turnout right now, there's a very heavy skew among older populations vote at much higher rates. Younger populations vote at much lower rates. And it just so happens that our elected officials also happen to reflect such a bias in a lot of ways. And our policies reflect such a bias in a lot of ways. And so there are some genuine questions that I don't necessarily have all the best answers to. That gets into kind of like zero sum sort of stuff. Like, to me, what's interesting is, can we find win-win opportunities where everyone's better off? And then there's the zero sum stuff where it's like one side's going to win and one side's going to lose. I'm personally less interested in that, but it is definitely present.
I think it is something we have to contend with, though, because, I mean, right now we do have a political reality in this country, and it's going to take an effort of somebody in the United States government who feels passionately about this and can gather enough support to institute this.
Right.
But I think the good news is that in the United States, too, it is not It's actually not the national government Correct. Who says,
yeah.
this is how voting happens. It is left to the states how voting is administered. So you can, maybe you can't win all 50 states at once, but maybe there's potential to trial this in California, do this in Hawaii, see how it goes in a state that is interested in doing this. I could imagine a place even like Wyoming, where it's very rural, or Montana, a very rural place. Not a lot of big cities where people are going to congregate. So it's hard to set up polling places that are going to be close to anybody in places like that, right?
Yeah, Alaska just announced a big pilot.
Alaska, did they? Oh, yeah. Cool.
Well, they're even more, not only is everything super spread apart, I mean, it's massive, yes. but also they have this like a huge percentage of the residents are only there for the summer months. And then it's a tiny population the rest of the year. And so if the election doesn't happen to take place in the summer months, they have a huge amount of remote voters.
November, for example.
Exactly. Yeah. And so they're really interested in it. Yeah. And to your point, that is what we're doing. We run a bunch of elections in Utah currently for reasons that I could get into if you're interested or not. Utah currently is far and away the currently most digitally forward place. And so one of their members of Congress has been elected through CIV. So there is one member of the House of Representatives it wasn't the general election, but it was one of the party primaries, which was the most competitive race that they were in because it's a heavily party dominated state. And like the state senator race that we just ran was also in Utah, and a bunch of other races they've done. Their governor has used it. A lot of their senators have used it. And there's other countries too. It's not just in the US. We ran an election in Canada last year. We ran an election in Madagascar last year. Oh, cool. People have used CIV in over 25 countries at this point, 330 cities at least. That was as of like 6 months ago numbers. So it's starting to happen. And the same thing happened with vote by mail. It started in like Washington State, I think was the first, or Oregon, and then Colorado and Utah and California. And then COVID happened and the whole country started doing it. And it was a good thing that these early adopter states had already worked out most of the kinks and figured out best practices. So that then it was ready for a larger scale. Yeah,
there's a ready-made thing. You want to adopt it, here's the playbook, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And there's all the, like, government elections are super interesting for a whole bunch of reasons, but there's lots of non-governmental use cases as well. So literally just this morning, we've been doing a bunch of votes for the Zcash Foundation, which is this very cool privacy-first cryptocurrency. It's like an encrypted private version of Bitcoin. And so they literally just this morning just announced their results. This is for their top... It's called their like community advisory board, and we ran a big one for their grants board last month. So that's just one example where we have a really cool one that's not public yet, but it's about to be announced with the XPRIZE Foundation that we're going to run next month. It starts next month, and it's going to run for many months. So there's tons of use cases. And then that we call these, those are like the government elections are like high stakes. These other ones, I sort of think of them as like medium stakes. It's not like intelligence agencies are trying to target them.
Yeah.
And then there's also low stakes. So we use our own software for like, where should we go to lunch today? Like, we're going to meet up with friends. It's like, do you want to go to this place or this place? We made it so easy, and we have really good voting methods as well. And so it's just like fun, and it's just like, why not?
I love that you can use the protocol for, you know, like electing a senator and electing and deciding where you're going to lunch.
Or like, where should we go on this date?
So you've been using CIV to do governmental elections, U.S., other countries. You've been using it in organizations. You've been using it to decide where to go to lunch. Is there anything that came up that surprised you? Good surprises, nasty surprises?
I mean, yeah, lots of things. Where to even begin? I mean, I come from the security world. Like, I love security. One of my favorite books is Cryptonomicon by Neal Stephenson, which is like super fun, like looking at, it's like code breakers in World War II on both the like Enigma, Alan Turing side of things, also the Pacific Theater. Like I personally love this sort of stuff. The average person doesn't. And as we've been building the software and giving it to election officials, one of the things that's been really shocking is honestly the feature they love most is that it makes it really easy to send out mass invitations to thousands of people or 50,000 people with a custom link for each of them with like just good tracking of like, did it actually land in their inbox or not? Do you have a mistyped email address? Mm-hmm. Did they vote or not? Just like the simple like nuts and bolts things. The average election administrator, I would say, cares about that on the order of about 100x as much as they care about like cryptographic privacy.
Wow.
Like, they do, it's just not what they're thinking about. We build it because we think it's important and there's like constitutional reasons why it's kind of necessary. But yeah, the different people have different priorities and are looking for different things. So that's been an interesting one.
Maybe we all care that it's secure, but we also kind of like expect it. And yeah. Then, you know, you get excited about the features that like delight you instead of just meet your baseline expectations, right?
Totally. Yeah. I mean, security is a really weird thing in a lot of ways, because the way that I've come to think of it, there's a lot of different ways to think about it. Like, one is that it's a process, not a destination. It's not a product so much, which is annoying because we named our thing Secure Internet Voting, implying it. So we might have screwed up there. But again, it's more about like our attitude is like we always want to provide deep options. You can always look into more details, make sure things are correct, and fix things when things do go wrong. Like, another really powerful aspect of this protocol is that right now with paper elections, in order to achieve privacy and everything, once you drop your vote in the ballot box, it's mixed up. Or if you're doing vote by mail, they like confirm the signature on the thing. And then the way that privacy is achieved, it's kind of funny when you think about it, is like there's a person whose job it is to look at the envelope and look at the signature and maybe verify it with a signature on file. And then their job is to open up the envelope, not look, turn their head and pull out the paper and put it in a separate pile. And that's
seems
the privacy.
Proof. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but it's kind of funny, but it mostly works. I mean, there's some interesting questions to ask about like scale and everything, but like this, if there are the attacks just compromising a small number of votes or compromising all the votes? There's some really genuinely interesting questions there.
And I think part of the security in that too is that it's not one central person every single one. It's like,
exactly.
Yeah. If like Dan, who happens to be opening my ballot, happens like looks at mine,
doesn't know me.
Yeah. It's pretty hard to influence or even to create any incentives to, you know, cheat there. Right.
And that's going back to the genuine concerns. That's one of the genuine concerns about doing things digitally. It's like, okay, our paper process is not perfect. Like your mail, if you do vote by mail, your mail person can literally just open up your ballot and look at how you vote. And if they see a yard sign in your house, they can just, it's not for the candidate they like, they can just throw away your ballot.
Yeah.
And so like that, it is not the case that our current process is perfect.
Yeah.
But one, to your point, and what sincere people express is that they'll use this term of like retail attacks, like small scale attack versus bulk attacks or like mass attacks. And once things are digitally, in theory, you can like press execute on the script and you've just switched out half of all the votes.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so that's a genuine sincere fear. But another point, one of the cool things that we can fix that is the good news. If you do it right, you can provide strong defenses against these kind of attacks. But one of the other really interesting capabilities I was going to mention is that right now the status quo for paper elections is the whole thing. You have to watch people drop their votes in the ballot box and like watch the whole process as it takes place. And once votes go in the ballot box, if it turns out you have evidence that your identity verification system was not very strong and people could have voted 10 times, the current status quo in the legal system is the losing candidates can file a lawsuit. And the judge says, okay, what sort of remedy would you like? And the only option is throw out the entire election results and possibly do a redo.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's just the proposed remedy is just throw out this county because they screwed up, but don't do a redo. And it's like a statewide election. And so all those people now just get disenfranchised. Whereas to contrast that with the digital stuff we're doing, it's more like email versus conversation or like text message. You know, it becomes asynchronous. And one of the interesting details about that is it means you can verify every single last piece after the fact. You don't have to watch it all happen in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And when there are mistakes, you can fix individual mistakes. You can say, okay, this particular voter cast a vote, but they actually weren't eligible. Or for some reason, they were able to cast multiple votes. You can fix those individual situations and retally all the results and clean things up. And so the short analogy there is it's like going from a typewriter to having a backspace key. And we do it, we use fancy cryptography things. So it's like append only and tamper evident. But the point is it's much easier to actually be sure you got correct results and not have to start all the way over.
Check out our next episode where we continue our conversation with David.
Vote by mail was invented in the Civil War, and we haven't really innovated since then.
Yeah, and our democracy was set up in the age of sail, right?
Correct, yeah.
Where wind was how we got across the ocean. Thanks for watching. Please like and subscribe. Take it easy.